afternoon, and welcome to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg, and we're live together for about 1 hour today, as we are every weekday, from 2 o'clock to 3 o'clock in the afternoon Pacific time. If you're listening to the live broadcast, it is a program in progress, and you can shape it, because I come to this microphone every day without any particular topic or agenda to discuss. We don't have a topic of the day. It's an open forum. Anything that you have to say or to ask about the Christian faith or the Christian walk, anything you have to say that might be in disagreement with this host or anything I've said, feel free to call. We'll be glad to talk to you about anything like that that's on your mind. Yesterday, we had some technical problems, to say the least. For the first 20 minutes, for some reason, the phones were not picking up the callers. People were calling, but nothing was coming through here. And then my call screening software on my computer was malfunctioning. And then at the end of the program, you may recall if you were listening, there was a loud dial tone that came over the air, just, you know, drowning out what I was saying for about the about 30 of the last 40 seconds of the program. So we had a comedy of errors there. However, today we have, I think, everything working pretty well. Certainly well enough to go normally, and we can take your phone calls. Let me give you a number, and you can call me if you'd like to in this coming hour. The number is 1-800-438-5090. That's 1-800-438-5090. Now, I know a lot of people out there have questions, but they tell me in person that they're just too shy to call up. And we try to make it as painless an experience as possible here. If you're not good at enunciating your question, we'll be patient with you. Actually, a lot of people don't call because they think that the question they have is, as they would say, a dumb question. They figure everybody else knows, and they're the only ones who don't know the answer. The truth of the matter is very few people study the Bible very much anymore. And the questions you have probably won't sound dumb to anybody else listening, right? If they do, it'll be to very few people. It'd be very dumb for you to have a question and leave it unanswered. And you'll find that in many cases, if you call with your so-called dumb question, there are many people out there listening and say, "Boy, I'm glad he or she asked that question because I've always wondered that myself." So feel free to call with any question you have about the Bible or Christianity. Or, as I said, if you disagree with the host, we'll make that as painless an ordeal as possible also. We're going to go to the phone lines, but let me give you the number again. It's 1-800-438-5090. We have a line open for you right now, 1-800-438-5090. Our first caller is Bruce from Beaverton, Oregon. Bruce, welcome to the Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Steve. Question Hi. On Gospel of John.
Okay.
A couple weeks ago, you answered somebody, and I thought you made some really great points that were really helpful. And you were saying, the question was, gee, why is John so different? You know, why do we have these long monologues that you don't find in the other gospel? And it's just so different. And you said, you know, John almost self-consciously wanted to write a gospel, you know, kind of fill in parts that maybe weren't in the other Gospels.
Yeah.
And I think you made the point that, you know, you look at the miracles that occur in John and how, you know, he doesn't repeat all the other ones that are in the other Gospels and so forth. So that is very helpful. And I'm taking BSF this year, Bible Study Fellowship, mm-hmm. on John. And one of the things that they point out was just after the early proclamation of the gospel, when Matthew, Mark, and Luke were already written, heretical tendencies rose, influenced by the pagan philosophies and so forth. Hellenistic Christians, in their desire to appear intellectual, were tempted to relate Christ to current philosophies. And then where I'm getting to, it makes its point. Therefore, it seems that John rewrote his gospel in its final form. So kind of implying that you know, he didn't write, what, I don't know, to 80 A.D. or something.
Something, so yeah.
Yeah, it's implying that he rewrote his gospel. I mean, it's stating that John rewrote his gospel in its final form to correct such tendencies and to set forth fresh aspects of the Lord's person and work. He had a particular emphasis upon the relationship of Christ, unique Son of God, and so on. It could be that the Holy Spirit led John to adapt phraseology and modes of expression current in that day, which had been popularized by the Qumran Essenes, because this gospel is directed to people who use that type of language. Well, here's what I want to ask you. You know, I'm kind of getting this. I mean, when you read John, it is, you know, such an emphasis on, you know, Christ was there in the beginning, before the creation. He was, you know, he's emphasizing that triune nature. He really hammers the divinity of Christ and these long monologues. And I'm wondering, do you sort of feel that some of this is being rewritten, you know, as it sort of suggests here, to address a particular heretical problem, and that, you know, this may be more John than it is the gospel as we know it in the synoptics?
Well, there is a lot of evidence that when the Gospel of John was written, part of the reason was to address some of the wrong views that had arisen at that late point in the first century.
Mm-hmm.
Among them would be, the beginning of Gnosticism. Gnosticism didn't really become a serious problem, as far as we know, in the church until the second century, but there were the beginnings of it, because mm-hmm. Gnosticism was a wedding of Greek philosophy with, Middle Eastern religion. Both Judaism and Christianity had their own forms of Gnosticism that arose. Gnosticism was sort of like a parasite that attached itself to an existing religion and redefined things and changed the meaning of them and so forth. And that happened to Judaism and to Christianity, especially to Christianity in the 2nd century and 3rd century. But there is evidence in John's writings. We especially see it in the first epistle of John, and also in some of Paul's writings, probably Colossians, where there seems to be the beginnings of Gnostic ideas that were creeping into the church. And so I do think that the Gospel of John sometimes states things the way he does in order to answer the Gnostics. We know also there appears to be an attempt in the Gospel of John to counteract what may have been a rising cult around John the Baptist. Because twice in John chapter 1, he says, John the Baptist was not that light. He was not the light. He was not the Messiah. He said he was not the Messiah. And even in John 3, he quotes John the Baptist saying of Jesus, he must increase, I must decrease. And there's a strong emphasis of John to emphasize to his readers, John the Baptist is not the guy to follow. He's not the light. He's not that true light. He came to bear witness of the light.
But,
so,
but there were, God, of there, course, was dead long before
right.
John
oh, yeah.
wrote.
Yeah, John the Baptist would never have approved if there were such a cult about him, and he was long dead, it's true. It'd be more like people following maybe someone like Edgar Cayce after his death, his teachings, or Nostradamus, although John the Baptist was not like them, and that John was a true prophet of God. But he was gone, and people tended to venerate him very highly.
I see.
And as one should think highly of John, but you could think too highly of him. So what I'm saying is that John's gospel has evidence in it that the writing of it was partly due to a desire to correct developments in the wrong direction in people's thinking in the Christian community.
Mm-hmm.
And Gnosticism.
Does he overstate things by doing that, or do you?
I don't think so. What I believe is, I don't think that he misrepresents anything that Jesus says.
Okay.
In other words, all the things that Jesus says in there, of course, I believe really were said. In fact, John's gospel is the only one of the four gospels that specifically claims to be reliable because it was an eyewitness testimony. Now, I believe that Matthew also is eyewitness testimony, and Mark has Peter's testimony. So, I mean, I recognize eyewitness testimony in more gospel than one, but John's is the only one that actually says this is eyewitness testimony. And therefore, John is saying very clearly that the things I'm writing really did happen, And I'm a reliable witness to it. I saw it myself and heard it myself. So I think that we have to take, unless we're going to discount John altogether as a witness, and that'd be a strange thing to do since he was one of the apostles and close, the closest one to Jesus, actually, the one whom Jesus loved. I think we have to say, well, this recorded words and deeds of Jesus in John are as reliable as any Gospels, words and deeds recorded of Jesus. But we also have in the Gospel of John the narrator's explanations about things. This is very common throughout the Gospel of John, and especially in the early chapters, that when John the Baptist or Jesus are quoted at length as saying something, that then the author jumps in and gives sort of a theological application or theological interpretation of what was said. So I don't think that he's misrepresenting anything that was actually said, but he definitely has an agenda to use the things that Jesus said and John said correctly to refute certain ideas that were out there. In other words, when he says, "In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God," and all, and goes on beyond there, of course, it's true. What he's saying is true, but his reason for saying it may have been polemic. You know, so we may not see as much of that in say, Mark or Luke.
When you say that interpreter's eye, you know, the narrator's eye, do you? I mean, when I read John, I see long monologues, you know, Christ discourses. I don't see a lot of, you know, John saying, "Well, I, as John, you know, would interpret it this way." I mean, are you saying his interpretation is embedded in what he quotes as coming from Christ?
No, that's not what I would say. Of course, the original Greek doesn't have any quotation marks.
Right.
And therefore, John did not indicate with such a convention as we would use, quotation marks, when he's quoting and when he's not quoting.
Mm-hmm.
And so interpreters pretty much have to make their own call about that. But you can see, for example, in chapter 3, I've got a red letter edition of the New King James. Now, the red letters, of course, suggest that the translators believe that these are the words of Jesus.
Mm-hmm.
And they make the red letters up through verse 21.
Mm-hmm.
But they do more than I do. I would say that Jesus' letters in John chapter 3 probably go up as far as verse 15, I'm thinking. But then verse 16 through 21, although the New King James still has them in red letters, I think those are John's application. And that's just, I just get that as an intuitive from the nature of the material. Now, if I'm wrong, the only way we would know it is by somebody else's intuition being different than mine, because that's all we've got.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
My impression is that Jesus is speaking verses 10 through 15 there in John chapter 3. But in verses 16 through 21, I believe that that's John's sort of springboards off of what Jesus says in verse 15. Jesus says that whoever believes in him should not perish but have eternal life. I think John springboards off that and says, "For God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten Son, that whosoever believes in him should not perish but have everlasting life." And he goes on, "God did not send his Son into the world to condemn the world," and so forth. And I think the same thing is true in when John the Baptist is speaking later on. John the Baptist, of course, there's no red letters about him, but as far as quotations go, we certainly have to include in quotations John's words, "I have been sent before him. He who has the bride," this is verse 29, "has the bridegroom, but the friend of the bridegroom who stands and hears him rejoices greatly because of the bridegroom's voice. Therefore, this joy of mine is fulfilled. He must increase, but I must decrease." Now, that's verse 30. I think that's the end of John speaking there, John the Baptist.
Mm-hmm.
Although the New King James doesn't put a close quote there, I think they should.
Mm-hmm.
Because from verse 31 on to the end of that chapter, I think it's the author giving his explanation.
Yeah.
Now, again, I'm just going by intuition, and that's fallible.
Yeah.
But my own, you know, I have had the advantage of reading it about 50 times and teaching it, and those are the impressions I have from it.
The bottom line for me is, you know, I really admire and respect your insight, and I guess what you're saying is that you have confidence that what John is relating here or remembering, you know, way after 90 A.D.
Maybe. It may not have been that late,
or
but go ahead.
85 or what, 80, but certainly after the synoptics, that what he's relating, I mean, you find genuine.
Yes, I do.
Rather than him taking some sort of, you know, he's got he's so concerned about dealing with these sprouts that he wants to hammer the divinity of Christ and you know, maybe embellishing things.
Well, if John embellished them, then he was not a faithful witness. And Jesus picked a really bad guy to be the one to report for him,
mm-hmm.
you know.
Yeah.
Now, of all the people in the world that Jesus could have chosen, he chose 12 that he felt would be trustworthy, and all of them were trustworthy unto death. Mm-hmm. I think that since the main primary assignment he gave them is to bear witness of him, of the things he said and did, mm-hmm. if any of them, especially John, proved unreliable in this, then that would reflect very negatively, I think, on Jesus' choices. I mean, it is possible, after all, to find people who will tell the truth.
Yeah. And, I'm also thinking of Revelation, you know, how John, I mean, his style. But I got your point, and I think...
Well, let me clarify something, too. I mean, people often have criticized the Gospel of John as presenting a different picture of Jesus than that of the other three Gospels, which we call the Synoptic Gospels. And one of the main issues is not only that John's material does not overlap very significantly with that of the other Gospels. Mm-hmm. I've already explained, I think, that was on purpose, mm-hmm. because he wanted to supplement rather than repeat what they said.
Yes.
But the other problem, the more significant problem, is that the discourses, as you mentioned, in John of Jesus are very different in nature than the ones in the Synoptic Gospels.
Mm-hmm.
Because in the Synoptic Gospels, Jesus almost never talks about himself. He talks about his Father, certainly, and he talks a great deal about love and about the need for people to do keep the spirit of the law and not be hypocrites and things like that. But he talks a lot about how to live,
mm-hmm.
in his teachings, like in the Sermon on the Mount and so forth in the other Gospels.
Mm-hmm.
There's very little in the Synoptic Gospels of Jesus actually talking about himself. And when he does speak, in the Synoptic Gospels, he uses parables and short aphorisms and sayings and so forth, whereas in the discourses in John...
You never have parables in John, right?
No parables. There's no parables in John unless we take, you know, I am the vine and so forth, but that's really more of a metaphor than a parable.
Yes.
But there's no parables in the teaching of Jesus in John. He's always talking about himself. In John's Gospel, it's all about himself and the Father, or not always, but most of the time.
Yes.
And also, he has these long, theological, difficult, constructed sentences and so forth that are not like the simple statements he made in the Sermon on the Mount and so forth. Now, these differences, though, they say, well, this is a different Jesus, a different personality and so forth. I think not. I think that Jesus was capable of addressing different audiences in different ways.
Good point.
Yeah, the teachings of Jesus in the Synoptics are given to peasants, including his own disciples who are peasants, and uneducated peasants.
Mm-hmm.
The discourses in John are usually to the religious leaders, the chief priests, the scribes and Pharisees. He's in conflict with them. And I think what we find is that Jesus was a man who could adopt his communication to his audience. When he's talking to simple people, he speaks in simple terms.
Yeah,
he's talking to educated people.
The,
people rise to their level.
The upper room discourse, where I think it's as profound as anywhere. It's just to the disciples, obviously.
Well, you're right about that, but I think that he's there answering their questions, which are also about him.
And he's trying to allay their concerns of what he knows is going to happen.
That's right. Yeah, I mean, you've got a good point there, that they are the only audience of the upper room discourse in John.
Mm-hmm.
And it does have its profound statements.
Mm-hmm.
But he's talking about the same issues that have been the focus of his other Jerusalem conversations in their presence.
Yeah.
Anyway, those are my thoughts. I think John knew what you'd never know from just reading the Synoptics. Because John had been with Jesus, he knew there were two sides of Jesus. The Jesus who could talk to the simple, uneducated people, and the Jesus who could hold his own against the scholars.
Yeah.
And the synoptics had only recorded one of those sides of Jesus, and I think John gives us the other side.
Is this pretty well covered in your lectures on the anywhere in your lectures?
I believe so. I believe that at my website or at the digitalministries.org, there should be my lectures on John there.
Okay.
At my website, we have the Life of Christ lectures, but they are pretty much a harmony of all the Gospels. So you'll find my comments about John mixed in.
Okay.
But I'm pretty sure there's a series of my teaching on John at the digitalministries.us.
I really, that's excellent, and I appreciate those great thoughts. I think you're so helpful to so many of us. Is your Seattle course filled up yet?
No, there's still room. I've got some applications, and I've got a whole bunch of verbals, you know.
Yeah.
People saying, oh, I'm praying about coming. But the verbal, very few of them are sure that they're coming. If they all wanted to come, we wouldn't have room for them all, but we do have room still for several.
Committed people, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, I'll let you get on. Thanks so much.
Okay, Bruce, thanks for your call. Good talking to you.
Bye-bye.
Bye now. All right. Now, Bruce mentioned our school in Seattle. If you're not familiar with that, it's the Great Commission School that I'm starting up again. I ran a school by that name in Oregon for 16 years, but I haven't for the past 10 years. I closed it up 10 years ago. And in the summertime, for 10 weeks, I'm running a portion of that school in the Seattle area. And it's there's no cost for the classes. It is a live-in course, though, because students will be coming from all over, well, possibly all over the world. We have one coming from the Ukraine, at least, but we from all over the country. And therefore, it's a live-in school. And we are limiting the number of people who can live in there to, I think, 12 is going to be the maximum. And because we want it to be small, and we don't have that much room. We're renting space at a YWAM base, a Youth with a Mission base in Monroe, actually. And they are going to charge us for room and board because it's not a YWAM school. We're an outside group coming in using their facilities. And they're going to charge $20 a day, which is nothing. That's going to include three cooked meals a day plus, you know, a room. And so room and board for $20 a day. I mean, do the math. That's like $600 a month. This is a 10-week school, totally $1,400 for 2.5 months of an education that is really... It's not me saying this, but people who've been through Bible college tell me this, that the education level of the school is graduate level. But if you have, if you made it okay through high school or through college, or you're capable of taking a college course, I think it'll be understandable if you're committed. And you can learn more about this school at our website. The website is thenarrowpath.com, thenarrowpath.com. And right in the middle of the page, near the top, it says the new Great Commission School. If you click on there, you will get information about it. And if you're, like, graduating from high school, you know someone who's graduating from high school who wants to go in the ministry, and they're not sure where to go, they might want to go to Bible college but can't afford it at this point, or maybe they're going to, but they'd like to get, you know, some real in-depth Bible teaching under their belt before going, using the summertime for that, this could be a good program for you. As I said, you won't find anything more affordable. Nor, in my opinion, will you find anything more thorough as a teaching through a large part of the Bible. Only Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy, Job, and the book of Mark will be covered in those 10 weeks. And that's a lot to cover in so short a time in the intense way that we do it. But it's a live-in immersion course, 10 weeks. It's a great way to use the summer if you're more interested in learning the things of God than surfing or something. Anyway, you can find information about that at the website. The website is thenarrowpath.com, and the school is called the Great Commission School. You'll see a link to it. If you'd like to be on the program, we're going to talk to Robert next from Salinas, California. But if you want to be on the program, we have a line open. You can call me at 1-800-438-5090. Got a question from the Bible or a difference of opinion? Give me a call. 1-800-438-5090. All right, let's talk to Robert next from Salinas. Hi, Robert. Welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Steve. I wanted to mention that debate at Sherwood Hall, what, about 3 weeks ago or so?
Yeah.
Filipino Church of Christ.
Right.
And, you know, I, a friend of mine that's a fairly new Christian was next to me, and he, you know, he said, he mentioned that, you know, the guy from the Filipino Church of God was really organized, and he, you know, said he had won the debate. And of course, I agreed. You know, of course, I know that, you know, I know about, you know, the Trinity, and I know that Jesus is God and the Holy Spirit is God. And of course, you know, he didn't convince me because I already know the scriptures. The brother that the Christian brother, I think he could have done a better job. You know, the other guy was more organized, and of course, you know, he had mustered all his troops there. He had all the people from the church, probably from all over California.
Yeah,
they were there, you know, and so they were like little robots, you know, just dancing, you know, just like he was in a church service, right?
Uh-huh.
That's what he sounded to me like. So could you comment on that, please?
Well, the brother who defended the Trinity is a good Christian brother and very evangelistic and so forth. He had even debated someone from that church about the Trinity 16 years earlier. And saw this as a long-awaited rematch. The problem is, about an hour and a half before the debate, the brother collapsed and lost consciousness. He actually just fell to the floor, and they called an ambulance and took him away to the hospital.
Oh, wow.
And they got him back up again. I think it was a blood sugar issue, but he didn't even know he had an issue. And so, you know, he didn't even get back to the debate at the starting time, which was 7 o'clock. It was delayed and so forth. And when he got back, he was somewhat disoriented, I think.
Right.
And I think he had every reason to be a little disoriented because he'd been, you know, he had just recently passed out. That was a strange development, of course. Now, I actually had dinner with him last night, and he felt that he didn't do as well as he should have. But one thing that I told him was that no matter how good he did, that was a setup job. I mean, the Filipino Church of Christ, who don't believe in the Trinity, did bring in about 800 of their people to the audience,
mm-hmm.
and, you know, overwhelmed it. And they were there to be to be cheerleaders. And
right.
And the Filipino Church of God, Christ guy, he could have said, you know, Mary had a little lamb, and they would have applauded him. You know, it was a strong psychological contest, and they do this. This is what they do to increase the numbers of their group. They go around, do these debates, and they ship in hundreds of their own people to overwhelm. And as you may have noticed, that the fellow who was arguing against the Trinity, against my friend, he just badgered him. You know, it no matter what Chauncey would have said, this fellow would have badgered him and made fun of him and acted like he hadn't said anything sensible. And he did say sensible things. Chauncey said very sensible things, but the guy just ignored them. And the guy didn't have to come up with good answers to Chauncey's challenges because the whole audience was with him.
Right.
And, you know, they were there to laugh when he made a mockery of something.
Right.
I mean, it was more of a show than it was a debate. And it's true. I think Chauncey would agree with you. He could have been more organized. He could have done better. But it was a pretty stacked deck against him in that setting.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Because you know, when I was, I went back when we had the that little intermission, and I was back there, and you know, there were some Filipino men, and I didn't know if they were Christians or they
uh-huh.
were, you know, from the Church of Christ. I just saw them, and I just, you know, I was just talking about John 1:1, how it says, I don't know why it says right there, it says the Word was, you know, the Word was God, is telling you right there that Jesus is God. Well, they just ran away from me. You know, they
yeah.
just kind of like, well, they, you know, like, you know, how the...
Yeah, most of the people, most of the ranks there were not, you know, well schooled in the Bible. Their guy, their champion, was a Bible professor from a Bible
right.
college, and they counted on him to know everything he had to know. I think the average rank and file of their group is not very biblically literate, and they didn't seem to know you know, when Chauncey was making a true point or not. Often he made very good points, and the audience verbally booed and
mm-hmm.
hissed and
yeah.
and laughed and clapped and
yeah.
I mean, it was the most, I've never seen a debate with such an interactive audience, but I guess that's
yeah.
just what they do.
Yeah.
That's how they make the other guy feel, you know, drummed down. Anyway, Robert, I got to take another call, but was there something else you wanted to say about that?
Well, yes, I wanted to ask you about Luke 11.
Mm-hmm.
Luke 11 in 24 to 26, where it's
okay.
talking about an unclean spirit going out and then coming back.
Yes.
I don't understand that.
Well, Luke doesn't give the final statement as Matthew does. Luke just says, when an unclean spirit goes out of a man, he goes through dry places seeking rest. Finding none, he says, I'll return to my house from which I came. And when he comes, he finds it swept and put in order. Then he goes and takes with him seven other spirits more wicked than himself, and they enter and dwell there. And the last state of that man is worse than the first. Well, that's in Luke, that's kind of a freestanding little teaching about demons going out of people. But in Matthew, it's put in a context and summarized by Jesus in a specific way to let us know what he was getting at. Because Matthew chapter 12 has those verses too, in Matthew 12, 43 through 45.
Okay.
But after all of that, after he says the last state of that man is worse than the first, Jesus said, so it shall be with this wicked generation. Now, that's the point he's making. He's saying that that generation that he had come to, who had seen and heard John the Baptist and had seen and heard Jesus and had received the benefit of Jesus' teaching and of his healing and his deliverance, that generation of people could collectively be seen as if it was like a man who had a demon cast out of him, a man who had been under the devil's power, but Jesus had come and brought light and brought deliverance, but only temporarily because they didn't receive Christ. Therefore, it's like a man who has a demon cast out of him, seven worse ones come back, and the latter state of that man is worse than the first. And Jesus said, that's what it'll be like for this generation. Namely, after I'm gone, after I've, you know, done my ministry of bringing salvation and deliverance and healing and light to this formerly devil-possessed generation, so to speak, they're going to go back to being possessed again. They're going to welcome back the evil spirits, and it'll be worse. There'll be seven times as bad. And I personally believe that the fulfillment of this is seen, for example, when you read the history of Josephus about the siege of Jerusalem in A.D. 70, which was in that generation. And, you know, you find that the people who were under siege truly behaved like crazy people,
uh-huh.
like madmen. I mean, they had the Romans outside the walls trying to get in to kill them. But they, the Jews inside the walls in Jerusalem, were killing each other. I mean, they're having like three-way civil wars, and they're burning up the food stores of one group out of spite when they all needed, and they were all dying of starvation. I mean, it was absolutely crazy behavior. When you read what Josephus wrote about what took place inside the walls there, you would say, well, these people act like they're demon-possessed. I mean, it's the whole country's gone berserk.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that that's the fulfillment of what Jesus said. Jesus said, well, you reject me. I've come and I've brought you light. I've cast out demons out of you. But if you don't come to me and be my disciples, you're going to find that seven times as much demonic problems are going to come upon you as a society. And I think that's what he's saying.
Okay. One more short question, Gerard. You know how in the Hebrew scriptures talks about, you know, God, his name in Hebrew was Elohim, right?
Well, that's one of the words that's used for God.
Okay. Now when it's talking about just like God, you know, not you know, like another God, not the God of the, you know, not
the pagan
Elohim,
gods.
You know, mm-hmm. What word do they use?
The word God singular is El.
Okay. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And Elohim is in the Hebrew like a plural of that.
Mm-hmm.
And so if they spoke of a pagan god,
uh-huh.
They would use the word El. If they were talking about the gods of the pagans collectively, they'd use the word Elohim, which is gods. The interesting thing is that the word Elohim, which in some contexts means gods, is used of the true God with a singular noun. I should say a singular verb. Elohim is a plural noun.
Yeah.
But in sentences where Elohim is being used as a name of the true God, there's this strange grammatical characteristic that they have the word Elohim, which is a plural word, but the verb in the sentence, which is, you know, describes the action of Elohim, is in the form that presupposes a singular subject, so that Elohim becomes at once a plural and a singular in some sentences. And when it does, then it is a reference to the true God, who's usually referred to as Yahweh.
Okay.
But when Elohim stands in with a different grammatical construction, for example, if Elohim is used with a verb that's in the plural sense, uh-huh. then it's talking about the gods of the pagan, the false gods.
Okay. All right. So they use the same word. I wasn't sure if there was another word that, you know, for not the true God, they would use a different word.
Well, the singular for God is El.
El, uh-huh.
Mm-hmm. And Elohim is simply a pluralization of it.
Yeah, in Spanish, you know, the word El means he, you know.
Like, yes, it does. Yeah.
It's really strange. Of course, you know, there was a lot of Jews in Spain too, so maybe that affected there.
You know, it's true. There were a lot of Sephardic Jews in Spain, and the Spanish language may have been affected in some ways by the Hebrew.
Yeah. All right, Steve. Thank you very much.
Okay, Robert. Thanks for your call.
You're welcome. Bye.
God bless you. Bye now. All right. We're going to talk next to Alan, who's calling from Milwaukee, Oregon. But we want to, first of all, give you the phone number because we have time for you to call. If you have a question or a comment, feel free to call 1-800-438-5090. That's 1-800-438-5090. All right. Let's talk to Alan from Milwaukee, Oregon. Hi, Alan.
Hi, Steve. Thanks for taking my call. Recently, I was in a Bible study. I have a bad feedback on this phone, but
I'm sorry. You sound good here. You sound good here.
We were going through the book of Ezekiel, and I came across some verses that seemed like a complete contradiction from ones that popped up into my head when I went through this. In Ezekiel 21, this has to do with God's protection of his people.
Okay.
And Ezekiel 21, verse 3 says, Behold, I'm against you, and I draw my sword out of its sheath and cut off both righteous and wicked from you. And then it says, verse 4, because I will cut off both righteous and wicked from you, therefore my sword shall go out of its sheath against all flesh from north to south. And when we read through that, the verses that popped up in my head that contradict that are in Psalm 91.
Those who dwell in the shadow of the Almighty will...
God's protection, and 1,000 will fall by your side, and 10,000 at your right hand, but it shall not come near you.
Right.
And I asked my pastor about this, and he just couldn't explain it. And I've read the context of both chapters, and it doesn't explain contradiction. And I just wonder if you might have a...
Well, I give you three possibilities, okay? Because to my mind, it's ambiguous. It could mean more than one thing. One thing it could mean, is that the righteous and the wicked will both be cut off from Jerusalem by the Babylonian invasion in two different ways. The wicked will be cut off by the edge of the sword, and the righteous would be cut off from the city by abandoning it, because the righteous did flee before Babylon destroyed the city. The righteous fled down to Egypt, and therefore they were cut off from the city. And therefore, Jerusalem was abandoned and lost all its righteous and its unrighteous people. They were all cut off from the city. So that's only A. That's one possibility. It would I think, answer to the facts of the case, but it may not be the right answer. Another would be, is that righteous may be one of those things that's kind of put in quotation marks. I'm going to cut off the wicked and the so-called righteous.
Uh-huh.
That is to say that everyone in Jerusalem was really corrupt. There were some who still pretended to be righteous, though, like the Pharisees did in Jesus' day. There were some who were pretending to be righteous and who the society thought of as righteous. There were others who were outright criminals and wicked people in that society. I mean, there were the good and the bad in the society. But even the good ones weren't really righteous by God's standards, just like the Pharisees. Jesus said to his disciples, your righteousness must exceed the righteousness of the scribes and Pharisees, or you won't inherit the kingdom of heaven. And so he spoke of the righteousness of the scribes and Pharisees, but we know that Jesus didn't consider them to be truly righteous in the sight of God, but they were esteemed as righteous. They would be regarded as the righteous in the country. And Ezekiel, God may be saying through Ezekiel that all the people in your society, those that you know to be wicked and those that you esteem to be righteous, they're all going to go down, because in fact they are all wicked. It's just that those who are called the righteous they're called that by concession, because that's how they would be regarded by the readers, the spiritual leaders, the priests and so forth, whom Ezekiel had earlier shown that they secretly went into the basement of the temple and they worshipped animals and pictures and the sun and so forth. And that's one reason why God was cutting them off, though they were the religious leaders. And in public, they seemed to be righteous and religious people.
Yeah, those are very good explanations, both of them, actually.
There is a third possibility, but I think the second one is probably the correct one. The third possibility is simply that in many disasters, there's wholesale destruction of everybody, including good people. I mean, good Christians die, in an atomic blast or in a plague or whatever, sometimes two. But when Psalm 91 says that the righteous, that no plague will come near their dwelling and so forth, I think what that's referring back to is referring back to the Exodus, where God sent the plagues on Egypt, but he didn't allow the plagues to come near the dwelling of the righteous who had the blood on their doors. And I think that there's a sense in which he's saying, in the judgment of God, the ultimate judgment of God, the righteous will always stand in a favored position over the wicked. God will always know where the righteous are. And even if they suffer a physical loss, even physical death, that they are spared in another sense. Remember, Jesus said that he that seeks to save his life will lose it, but whoever loses his life for my sake shall find it. And I think it is a truth. I don't know if that's the truth that Ezekiel is giving in this passage. See, all three of the explanations I gave you are all truths. But as far as which one this passage is saying, I'm not sure. But I think probably the second answer is what Ezekiel has in mind, that the people who are thought to be righteous, as well as those who are known to be wicked, they're all going to go down because they're all really wicked.
Well, all three of those possibilities are a lot better explanations than I've had so far. So I appreciate those, and it's given me a lot better understanding of it. So.
All right. Well, a lot of times I don't know the answer, but I know some possible answers. And I can tell you which one I think is most likely.
Yeah. Thanks, Steve.
Okay, Alan. God bless you. Thanks for your call.
Bye.
Bye now. Okay. Our next call is going to be from William in Las Vegas, Nevada. Hi, William. Welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks
for
calling.
Hey, William. This is William.
Yes.
I got two questions. My first one is in Genesis chapter 1, when he says, in the beginning God created the heavens and the earth. Mm-hmm. I was just curious as to if the heavens are like the stars and the planets and the galaxies, and since they were created and had to have a beginning, what do you think was there or what existed before all those stars, planets, and galaxies were created by God? And my second question is, when Jesus said greater works than these, assuming these were his miracles and his works, what could possibly we could do better, greater works than the ones he did? Anyway, I'll listen off the air. Thank you.
Okay, William, thanks for your call. God bless you. First question. What was there before God created the heavens and the earth? Well, one thing we know is there was God. And God may have been all there was for all eternity before that. And we need to get that phone hung up. Okay. It may be that from all eternity, God was there and there was nothing else there. We don't know because we're not told. It's also possible that God had done other projects before this present universe. There may have been a series of them. We might be the millionth. God has been around forever and ever and ever. That'd be gazillions of years and more. He might have gone through the whole process of a Big Bang and the development of a universe and the whole human type history and end of the world and so forth many times in other circumstances. I don't say that he did. I'm just saying that we don't know that he did or didn't. The thing we are told is what he did to begin our story, because our story is the one that we relate to and that we have a role in and that he wants us to understand. God has been silent about a lot of things that we are curious about. He's never told us whether there's life on other planets, for example. And even on important things like, what happens to us in eternity after we die, there's not a lot of information there in the Bible. The Bible doesn't focus on those things. There's not a clear description of heaven, for example, except perhaps in the book of Revelation, which has a lot of symbolism, and it's hard to know how literal to take it. My observation would be that God has told us not the things that we want to know sometimes, but the things we need to know. And therefore, he hasn't told us what he was doing before he made our present universe and our planet and our species. But he has told us all we need to know about that, because that's the stage upon which we play out our role in the drama. And we probably will know the answers to these questions when we actually are with him. You know, we'll have all eternity to be learning stuff. And it's possible that the things that he hasn't told us at this point will be made known to us at that time. It's also possible that when we get there, we'll be smart enough to know that it doesn't matter and we may not even care to know. But in any case, I think we need to be content to know what God wants us to know and what he has told us, and that's about all we can do. Before the heavens and the earth existed, God was there. If there was any other previous universe or whatever, we do not really know. I don't have any serious problem with the view that most scientists hold, that there may have been a big bang. And when God said, let there be light, there may have been a big bang. I would differ from many who say that this bang took place billions of years ago. If it did, I'm ignorant of that, and that's possible. I'm ignorant about many things. But I don't think it's necessary to assume that the bang that began the universe had to have taken place billions of years ago. But that's not an issue to me. It is to some people. It is not to me. All I can say is that if the Big Bang is true, then it all began with something very, very, very small that God apparently had brought into being. And it had all the subatomic particles of the universe all bunched together in a little dot, which scientists say was smaller than a period on a page. In fact, microscopic. And I'm not sure why they have to believe that, but it could be true. I don't know. But at one point, and I would say probably when God said, let there be light, or at least when he said, let there be heavens and earth, then that thing blew up and everything began. And it may have developed quicker than billions of years. I'm not sure how we would know for certain about that, unless we were told. And the Bible sounds like it tells us. It sounds like it tells us that it wasn't billions of years ago. But I don't make that an issue, because I don't consider it to be one of the things that God actually hangs his authority upon. He does tell us about the creation, but his authority is more based upon the fact that he's the creator rather than how long ago he did it. Though there are time indicators in the scripture. All right, your other question was when Jesus said about his disciples that they would do greater works than he had done. He says, the works I have done you shall do, and greater works, he said to them in the upper room in the Gospel of John. Your question was, well, what greater works could there be than what Jesus did? And that is something that I've wondered myself. I'm not sure I know the answer to. There's a couple of things that can be suggested. One is that, first of all, when he says greater works than I have done, we might think he means greater miracles than he has done. But Christ's works were not restricted to miracles. Christ did miracles, but he did a lot of things. When James says faith without works is dead, he doesn't mean faith without miracles is dead. Works is simply activities, things that people do. And Jesus did a lot of things besides miracles. We tend to focus on the miracles because they're the most stupendous of the things he did. But what he did with his life in general was to reach out to the disenfranchised and to bring reconciliation to them with God. That was his whole mission. In the course of that mission, of course, he worked miracles. Of course, he died and he rose again. Those are all part of his mission and different, with differing degrees of importance to it. But the mission of Christ and all of his works were associated with bringing reconciliation between God and the prodigal world. And there's a sense in which Jesus could say, the works I've been doing, you're going to do it, and you're going to do more than me. You're going to do greater works, more expansive, broader. What you do is going to, you know, exceed what I have done, in the sense that Christ, of course, limited his activity to the Jewish people in a small geographical area, where the disciples were going to go out and do the same works that Jesus did all over the world to every nation. That's bigger. That's greater. And that could be what he means. He may simply mean that you're going to be doing the same things I do, only on a grander scale. Now, he didn't necessarily have to mean that the miracles that they worked would be more stupendous than the ones he worked. after all, he did walk on water. I've never, I don't really have any documented cases of Christians walking on water. Jesus raised the dead. I do believe that's happened. In the book of Acts, we read of it happening, and there may have even been other cases throughout history of the dead rising. It's not very common, but it wasn't very common in the ministry of Jesus either. We only know of three cases in his ministry where he did that. But the point is that the miracles Jesus did are kind of hard to exceed in amazingness. If you want to talk about amazingness of miracles, the ones that Jesus did are just about as amazing as any that can be imagined, and we don't have to assume that the disciples would do miracles that were more amazing than the ones Jesus did. To say they did greater works, I think, would simply mean, he first says, the works that I do, you shall do, and greater works, which, to my mind, means that you're going to do the same works I did, only in a greater way, or on a grander scale, or perhaps we might say more broadly. Hard to say, but that's what I'm inclined to believe was his meaning there. And so I hope that helps. It is a question I have had myself, and I've never answered completely to my own satisfaction. I'll just let you know that. But that is how I have wrestled with it in my own case. So I appreciate your call on that. Now, I don't know if we have any other callers. Actually, my call screen software just crashed on me. No big problem. It happens every once in a while when I leave it idle. After about 15 minutes, it goes out on me. Anyway, the point is, you are listening to The Narrow Path, and if there is another caller, I'd ask my call screener to let me know. The number to call is 1-800-438-5090. I do have a question that was just written to me today by someone named Bo, and he said, "Steve, my question is in regards to Proverbs 16:5. He says, what does it mean when it reads, though they join forces, they will not go unpunished? What force are they trying to join? And are they in a state of punishment because they refuse to repent? Thank you, Steve." Bo. Well, okay, here's what the proverb says. Everyone proud in heart is an abomination to the Lord. Though they join forces, none will go unpunished. Now, when he says the proud are not going to go unpunished, even if they join forces. Joining forces means if they join together as a team to fight concertedly against God's judgment, they will not succeed. The judgment will still fall upon them. That all of their concerted efforts together are not sufficient to stop what God intends to do to them. So it says the proud, everyone who's proud in heart is an abomination to the Lord. And if someone's an abomination to the Lord, of course, the Bible teaches very plainly, there will be a judgment. There will be a punishment. And this proverb is simply saying that punishment will come upon them undeterred by any concerted efforts on their part to prevent it. Though they join forces simply means though they join together as an army, even, to resist God, they will not succeed. You've been listening to The Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg. We are a listener-supported ministry. If you'd like to write to us, you can write to The Narrow Path, P.O. Box 3633, Santa Cruz, California, 95063. You can find that address at our website. Many resources, MP3 files and written resources, free to you, nothing for sale, at our website, thenarrowpath.com. Tonight I have a Bible study which I do weekly in Santa Cruz. Information can be found at the website. If you want directions to it, if you're in Santa Cruz, you can call 425-1623. That's 425-1623. Thanks for joining us. Again, the website is thenarrowpath.com. I hope you'll tune in again tomorrow, and we'll continue our discussion. God bless you.